Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is the last episode of The Bad Apples. Yes, it's true, this is episode 20 of season 5 of The Bad Apples, and this is the last episode of The Bad Apples. After this episode, you will no longer hear a Bad Apples Oddcast, or Speakscast for that matter. Because as of the end of this episode, as of the beginning of Season 6, I'm going to turn this show into a new name, and it's going to be called The GNU World Order. I know that you probably don't appreciate change any more than I do, but I was writing an article for a website about technology and stuff, and it came up that I was a podcaster, and they wanted to know what the name of my show was, and I found myself really, really having a hard time naming my show, because as I've discussed before, The Bad Apples really, really does, when it comes to Unix-y kinds of things and technology, if you say the word Apple, there's really only one way to think about that. And the first thing that comes to mind is the computer, the brand. And especially since the computer, the brand, lays claim in a very serious way to Unix, And I mean, they are Unix, right? I mean, it's underneath all of that stuff, there is Unix, okay? So, I mean, it's really kind of awkward for me to say that, oh, my show is The Bad Apples, and it's about Linux. Because people just don't understand, you know, and it looks bad. And it looks like I'm promoting a brand that, you know, I really don't want to promote. So I thought to myself, well, and you know this, I mean, a couple of episodes, well, maybe at the beginning of the season, practically, I got an alias. That was klaatu.hackerpublicradio.org, and that points to The Bad Apples, so I could list that as a web URL to the site. But that's not really what was being asked this time when I was writing this article. It was about what is the name of the show, and people do ask, what's the name of your show? And you can't really say, oh, it's klaatu.hackerpublicradio.org. That's not the name of your show. And then that also kind of almost, if you say something like that, then it almost sounds like your show is the Hacker Public Radio, and that is not my show either. So, and that's Enigma's show, and I wouldn't want to take that credit where credit was not due. So the point is that I needed a new name, and the best name I could think of, heck, was GNU World Order, because that's advertising a brand that if we could call it a brand, just a vulgar term. It's advertising a name that I would actually want to advertise. So GNU World Order, and it's got that, you know, slightly propagandic slant to it, which I've always appreciated. And yeah, it's cool. I like it. The GNU World Order. Now, the bad thing about changing the name to the podcast, to the Oddcast, is that a lot of times when shows do that kind of thing, they go on, you know, down this other path, and it gets really weird and bad and stuff. Happily, I'm going to tell you that I'm not going to make any changes. I've been exactly the same for pretty much, well, 4 seasons after the first dark and dismal season. So it's going to be the same show, still Og and Speaks only, and still me. And so aside from, like, the chorus girls and the lounge singer and the magician act that I've got coming in for the next season, it's pretty much going to be the same show. So don't think that it's going to change. It's just literally a different name. And because I'm too lazy to move files from one server to another, it's going to all still be on the badapples.info. So basically, I'll just go out and get, like, a domain, GNUWorldOrder.com. Something cheap, because I'm really not that dedicated to the idea of disassociating myself from The Bad Apples. But I do want to have a name that I can say, that's my show, and then if they turn it on, they'll hear me say, this is episode 1 or 0 of season 6 of the GNU World Order. You know, then, okay, now I've got an identity that is not The Bad Apples. And so that's the big news this show. The other big news is that, strangely enough, just after I announced something about the GNU World Order, I'm going to be reviewing FreeBSD this episode, which does not use the GPL. in fact, and about the only thing GNU you can find by default on their system, I think, is the GCC, and probably not that for much longer, because they don't really want to be using that many GNU utils, from what I understand. But we'll be talking about that later. But first I wanted to talk a little bit more about DocBook. You remember DocBook from last episode. I was talking about it, and in fact, I just got finished talking about it because I'm in this nice sound booth. Remember that last episode? Yep, I'm just doing two episodes at the same time, but to you, weeks have passed. So, last episode I left you on the ground running with DocBook. So you could write in DocBook with your three tags that we learned, four tags, and you could transfer, you could process the DocBook sources to HTML or to PDF. On this episode, I would like to talk about how I do all of that stuff, and it's complex. It's not super complex. I mean, I'm still Class 2. I'm not a programmer, but it's more complex than what I gave you last episode, but it's really, really nice. I didn't want to just keep going with all this random, you know, code-sounding stuff last episode, so I cut it short. Just short of touching on this kind of information. But this is my workflow, and this is how I can work and kind of make DocBook work for me. So there's two types of writing in my mind. There's the creative writing, and then there's the technical writing. And I guess you could even say, like, the scholarly writing, so that would be three types. But the idea is that there's certain writing, at least for me, that you can sit down and you just kind of, it's more of a task. It's not something that you actually have to dream up, you know, you know what you have to write about. Let's say it's an article about installing Fedora or running KDE on Fedora, or I should say the Plasma Desktop, the KDE's Plasma Desktop on Fedora. Those are articles. I mean, obviously they require creativity and stuff, but at the same time, there's a certain degree of just kind of getting the work done. It's almost a craft more than it is an art. That stuff I can write in DocBook from the very beginning and do pretty well at. Now, the other kind of writing, the more creative stuff, where you're just sitting down to writing, you're writing for fun, or you're writing for your job that happens to require creative writing, who knows? But the brain works differently in those cases, at least mine does. And having to worry about a DocBook tag at that time is completely not something that I want to do. So if I'm doing creative writing, and even some of the technical writing, I like to start out in plain text, like not a markup tag in sight. And I do this for two reasons. One is what I just mentioned, the brain kind of works differently. Doesn't want to have to think about tags when it's still trying to figure out, you know, how to make a complete sentence sound good. The other reason is because if I try to do tags in a document, invariably I forget to close a tag, I forget to open a tag, I close something twice, whatever. But there's always an error at the end. And yes, you can have sort of compiling errors, as it were, when you're processing your DocBook documents. You'll try to XML to HTML, and it'll say, well, I can't do that because you've never closed your chapter tag. Or, you know, your chapter tag is over before it begins. You know, just random things like that. And probably a great reason that I'm not a programmer, because I just can't get the syntax of things right. I can't get the tags right, much less, you know, program. But the answer to this for me is to write in plain text and then use a script, Perl script in this case, to then take my plain text and insert all the fancy little markup tags that it can auto-detect. And then I go through and correct all the auto-added markup tags. Because obviously, I mean, you want to lay it out just the way you want it, so obviously you're going to have to go do that. But for me, it's a lot easier to do that, you know, to use this script, than it is to try to actually either do the tags while I'm writing, or go back through and try to add the tags manually later on. Because if you do that, just trust me, there's going to be a billion para tags that you're going to have to insert, and it'll just cramp up your hand in like 10 minutes, maybe less. So using a Perl script really, really helps me out here. And the Perl script that I use is txt2docbook. That is txt and then the number 2 and then the word docbook. And that can be found at txt2docbook.sourceforge.net. It's a quick little download. It's a zip bomb, I think. Might not be. It could just be a nice, friendly zip. But you download it, you unzip it, something happens, it ends up in a folder. Now, I'm unfortunately too much of a Perl noob, and if you're not, you can certainly email me and tell me how to fix this issue. But I can't get it to run outside of its own folder. So if I'm in my docbook folder, for instance, I shouldn't say my docbook folder because I don't organize my things that way, but if I'm in, you know, Project X folder, which has all my docbook sources in it, and I'm done my plain text and I want to turn it into docbook, then I can't seem to invoke the docbook script, this TXT2 docbook Perl script, from my Project X directory. I can invoke it, but it crashes. It says, or it gives an error. It says that it can't find the, I don't know, output.pl and the something else dot something. So it's looking for something in, like, maybe a Perl path that it can't find because I'm not in that directory. So what I end up doing usually is I simply do a push D over to /bin/txt2docbook. I run the script on the sources that's elsewhere, and that deals with that fine. It doesn't care. It just wants me, my cursor, my current directory to be that directory, the txt2docbook. So I run the script against the source code that I need it to, or the plain text stuff that I need it to then translate into docbook, and it works fine. And then I pop D, and I'm back in my old directory again, Project X. So that's the easy way to do that. The easier way would be to learn a little bit more about Perl and figure out how to set some kind of Perl environment variable or environment path or whatever, but or executable path, I'm not sure. But I don't know how to do that yet. But it's a really handy script, and what it does is it looks for line breaks between paragraphs, and if it sees that, then it adds a para tag. If it sees something that looks like a list, I think it does list tags as well. It also does an article tag at the top and the bottom, and a book. Does it do book tag? I don't think it does a book tag at the top and the bottom. I'm not sure. I think it makes everything an article, which could work, but not for me. So what I do is I go back through and make all the article tags chapters, and then I just go through and make sure that everything is laid out like I want. Like sometimes I'll want a block quote or maybe some list that I wanted to be a list wasn't detected as a list, and so I'll add the list tags myself. Little things like that. But it makes it a lot easier and kind of avoids a lot of potentially broken tags that don't validate when I'm actually processing the stuff later on. Now there's two things about the TXT2 docbook that you have to do in order to get it to work. One is to make it executable, so you chmod plus x txt2docbook.pl. That was easy. And then the other is to configure the output.pl file, which it happens has in it a function to write the docbook header, which is that the declaration at the beginning of any XML file. I mean, if you look at something that validates as XHTML and look at the top, there's this funky, weird docbook declaration about what version it is and all this other stuff. So you need that at the head of your docbook file, and this script will do that for you. So you can either add in your little docbook path there and let it do that for you, or you can do what I do, which is just comment it out. And it tells you that you can comment it out, and you can't miss it. It's right at the top of the file, practically. It says, important, you must fill this out or comment it out. So I comment it out, and then I put my own docbook header in there with a shell script later on. And the reason I do that will become clear soon when I talk about how I structure my docbook files. But that is the TXT2 docbook Perl script. Check it out at txt2docbook.sourceforge.net. It's a really nice little script and makes writing in docbook a lot easier because you get to skip so many tags that you would otherwise have to put in. Keep in mind that the plain text, when you're writing, traditionally writing paragraphs was done without any kind of break between the paragraphs. You simply hit return once, and then you hit the tab key, and it indents that first line, and then you keep writing. That's how books are actually written. Like if you look at a book on the shelf, like one of those old ones that still came on paper. If you pick one up, like a dime novel, here's one, The Ruins of Earth, 16 different sci-fi stories, including Philip K. Dick, Kurt Vonnegut. Not bad. So if I open this up, it looks like all the paragraphs run right into each other, and there's just a tab delineating where each paragraph begins. That's the traditional way of doing it. Now, go online and read the same set of stories or some set of some document, and you'll notice that all the paragraphs have a blank line, a single blank line between them. That is something that, I mean, as far as I know, kind of came about with the internet. I had never seen that before that I can recall, unless it was like a section break, like it wanted to transition from one character to another character's narration. They might have a big blank space between the paragraphs. But now we have spaces between all the paragraphs. So if you do that for this little docbook script, it likes that a lot because it sees that one blank line. So it's an end of paragraph, return, and then return again, begin your new paragraph. It sees that and says, oh, that is a paragraph, let me add a para tag to that, to the top and the bottom of that. If you don't, and one of my documents, I'd written it very traditionally, not realizing that I was supposed to do the new modern paragraph thing, and the little docbook script saw it as one big paragraph, so I had to go through and add my own para tags, which was a pain in the neck, believe me. So that's just a little tip about if you're going to do it my way and do the whole plain text first, and then translate it with a script, give yourself that blank line between the paragraphs. Now the other tip, and this is why I comment that docbook header thing out, is to keep your chapters or the sections of your book, whatever you would call them, I call them chapters, keep those chapters in separate files. And this, again, is not something that really came immediately to me. I didn't really think to do that. You know, you're writing and you just kind of hit return a few times and make some kind of dotted line or something and call it a new chapter, and that's that. But it turns out that if you actually make each chapter its own file, so you've got 01.txt, 02.txt, 03.txt, and so on, then you'll be able to concatenate them together later on. But in the meantime, you get really nice bite-sized pieces that you yourself can keep organized a lot easier. So much easier to go into these separate files and make your edits and proofread and go in and make corrections to all the little docbook tags and stuff like that, because I just, could just be me, but I can't deal with a document that I'm supposed to be editing and it loads and it's just, it's thousands and thousands of lines of text and you have no idea where to go or how to get there the fastest possible way. So I like to break it up into chapters. I start with 01.txt and go through, I don't know what, till 30, let's say, .txt. Now, once all that's done, and I've ran my little text txt to docbook.pl script against all the files, and then I'm ready to go, then I create a 00.xml file. And in 00.xml, I hard code my book tag, my opening book tag, and then I do a book info tag with the author first name and surname, and it is, they call it surname, not last name, the version number, the license, an abstract or a summary, and some keywords, and whatever else you want to put in there, and then you close your book info tag, and then you put a little note to yourself not to close your book tag. That's what I do. And now you've got a nice little document with the book tag in the front of it, and that's kind of one book end over on the left. For the other end of the book, I create like a acknowledgments or a credits. I just call it credits because it's faster to type, but you could call it acknowledgments or appendix or whatever. And I don't give that a suffix at all. And that's just, a lot of my suffixes, like the .txt, .xml, or the absence thereof, are simply dictated by what kind of little bash for loop I'm going to write, you know, so that for instance, the little Perl script is going to be run against everything that ends in .txt. So if I create my own front of the book and call it XML already, and I create my end of the book and don't call it anything, then they're not going to get included in any kind of shell script that processes everything that's .txt. Things like that. Just little conventions that I've developed. They're not necessarily the best way to do things or whatever, but I'm just letting you know that's how I do it. So I create a credits file, and in there I put all my little credits, all the little notes that I need to, like acknowledgments and things like that, what my sources were, whatever it is, and then I close the book tag there. Okay, so on either end of this block of XML files, I've got a 00 and a credits, and it's my opening and my closing book tag, most importantly. Now, one more thing I need, and that's the docbook header. Now, because I'm portable, because I go from computer to computer to computer, I have a way that I not automate, but actually prompt myself for the information that I need. And I just do this with a config.sh, and I copy this config.sh into every docbook directory that I ever make, you know, whether it's Project X, Project Y, Project Z, whatever, Plan 9 from Outer Space, whatever it might be, then I have my little config.sh thing in there, and I actually require that I run that, and I dictate that in my make file. So I do a .config.sh, and that first says, okay, what's your docbook path? And then it even gives me a little listing, because I can't ever remember anything. It gives me a little listing. It echoes to the terminal a little listing of all the docpaths that I myself typically are going to be using. And most recently, that's really been either Ubuntu at Work or FreeBSD out at the internet cafes. So I then select which one I want. I paste it back in. I hit return, and it echoes the proper docbook header with that path into a file called docbook.header. So now if you think about the full contents of my book, I've got first docbook.header, then I've got my 00.xml, which opens my book tag and gives me some book meta information, and then I've got 01.xml all the way through, let's say, 30.xml, and then I've got my credits file. So obviously the way to get all of that stuff into one processable docbook entity, I would simply cat all those things into redirect into probably just a temp.xml, to be honest, tmp.xml, because that way I know I can delete it later on. And then I could do whatever I want to with that temp.xml, right? I could run xml2 against it, and then fop against the output of that, or something else. I could do, I could get a script to turn it back into plain text. I could download a script to translate it over to some other format that I can't think of right now. So there you go. It's really, really cool. But it doesn't stop there, my friends. Oh no. No, it gets cooler. It does. There are make files out there, but before I even begin to talk about make files, let's take a coffee break.
Space Coffee. The choice of United Planetary Space Cadets all over the galaxy.
I hope you had a lot of coffee, because we're about to delve into make files. And make files, as everyone knows, are big and scary, right? Wrong! They're actually really easy. It's amazing. I mean, I always kind of thought they were very mystical and incomprehensible myself, but they turn out to be quite simple. They can get complex, obviously, but, I mean, the concept is really easy to understand. So let's just make one really quick. It's really simple. So the basic syntax is foobar, and foobar can be anything you want, believe it or not, and then the colon, and then space, targets, whatever target files you want to insist that your make file find, and then an instruction set. So yes, it's a little bit like a shell script, but it's not exactly. So you'll get the feeling for it once you see one done. So makefile, we'll just open up a text editor and call it makefile, and I believe it has to be capital M-A-K-E-F-I-L-E, and the only thing that's capital in there is the M in makefile. Nothing else is capitalized. So you make a makefile, and let's do one for the HTML processing. So you simply type in HTML, and now you could call it anything. You could call it Klaatu. It doesn't really actually matter. You could call it web, but you have to choose some term. So that would be a good term, I guess, HTML. But you could call it web, too. So HTML colon space docbook.header star, or rather asterisk, .xml space credits. And that would be all. Those are the target files. That means that when you run make HTML, GNU make or GNU GCC or something, I think it's GNU make. Yeah, GNU make checks for something called docbook.header. It checks to see that there are XML files present, and it checks to see that there's a file called credits present. The advantage to that is that if you know, for instance, that the command that I'm ultimately going to run within this make file is going to fail if there's no, for instance, docbook.header, which is true, then make actually makes sure that you've got the docbook.header file in there. And if you don't, it will say, I can't find one of your files. And then you remember, oh yeah, it's because I'm doing it this weird convoluted Klaatu way, and he has me doing a .config.sh in order to get my docbook header onto my file, and that creates the docbook.header. So that's kind of a check to make sure that everything you were supposed to do up to this point has been done. So then you do a return, and you do cat space docbook.header space *.xml space credits space redirect, so that's the greater than sign, space tmp.xml. And that's pretty easy. We're obviously just catting all of the files that we want in our big main file into a big main file, and we're calling it temp.xml so that we don't confuse it with anything else. And then you do a return again, next line, xml2 space html space temp.xml space -o space ./html. So that's the old familiar xml2 command that we learned last episode. So it's just xml2 and then space html being the format that we want to end up in, space temp.xml, that's the input file, space -o space ./html, and you save that document. And now literally, if you run in that current directory, if you run make html or whatever you used for that one term, that magical term, it could be make web, could make online, could make Klaatu, could make anything, but whatever you named it, and I named it html colon, so it's make html, then voila, it runs those commands. It checks to see that docbook.header is there, it makes sure that everything else is there, and then it cats everything together, dumps it out into a temp.xml, and it makes the html files. And it works like a charm. It's amazing. Now, what's the big advantage to this? Well, the big advantage to this would be because you've got a lot of probably text that you're doing. Eventually, you're going to find a bug in your text, right? A typo, a spelling error, something's wrong. Or if it's like Slack or Media, someone's updated their version number, and you need to go back and change the version number that you're talking about in your text. So the advantage to something like a makefile is that you can go back and do as much changing as you want in your source files, and then to get it back out into the state that you wanted it in the end, all you have to do is type in make HTML. It's as simple as that. And it's very easy, and it's a great way to manage a lot of different commands that you would otherwise have to do. Now, granted, if you're just doing a make HTML, that's not really that big of a deal, but there's more. So let's write more make file stuff. And in this case, we could do a make PDF, and that would be the same idea, really, but we'll do it just so that we can reinforce it. So open up your make file again, and below the HTML section, let's do a PDF colon space docbook.header, because we want to make sure that's there, and then *.xml, and then credit. So those are our targets. If you don't have those, don't proceed. And then return, and the first command would be cat docbook.header *.xml credits redirect to temp.xml. And of course, if we wanted to abstract that cat line such that it only does that once, we could make a new command like make all or something like that, and that way we would only be catting out to temp.xml when we say to do it. But I tend to do it this way, even though sometimes it gets in the way. But you can play around with this kind of stuff later. And then next line, xml2 space fo space temp.xml space -o space ./pdf. So again, that is, what would that be? That would be the xml2 command, obviously dumping out an fo file into our PDF directory in that same directory. And then finally, you would finish it off, next line, fop space ./pdf/temp.fo space ./pdf/mybook.pdf, for instance. So now if you again save and go back out, you could say make PDF, and it would spit out a PDF in the end. Now, It may or may not interfere with you because there's that temp.xml already left over from your HTML attempt, right? Well, there's an easy way to clean up all the little spare files that get left around after processing your text. And you've done it before, I'm sure. If you've ever compiled code, you've probably typed in make clean. And all make clean is a list of things to delete that's contained in the make file. So to do that, it would be opening back up your make file, and you could name the process clean. So clean colon return, because we don't actually want it to check for anything. We want it to clean no matter what. We don't care what's present in the folder. We just want it to do a clean. So we do have to define what that is, and it is -rm, not just RM, but -RM space -F space .PDF/*.FO. What else do we want to get rid of? Space .PDF/*.PDF. Because we probably want to ditch any previous PDF attempts that we've made. Space temp.xml. Obviously, we want to get rid of that because we don't want that one lying around. And then maybe even, and this would be up to you, a *.header so that we get rid of our docbook header. I have it in there because a lot of times when I'm doing a make clean, I'll be on a different system, and if I do a make clean and it removes everything but the docbook header, then I try to do the processing and it says, oh, you can't find your docbook, the actual docbook path is wrong. So I kind of force myself to regenerate that more often than I probably should, but that's how I do it. You could also get rid of course, .HTML/*.HTML. Get rid of all those HTML files. So that's a pretty drastic clean. And one trick that I've seen people do is make tidy. And make tidy would be just kind of like, just get rid of the temp.xml, just get rid of the .fo, you know, little things like that. Don't get rid of the docbook header. Don't get rid of all the HTML. It really just depends on your workflow and how you want to manage this. I mean, it's easy to change, and certainly with tidy and clean, you should only be removing stuff that's really easy to regenerate anyway. So that's how you do it. So both for tidy and clean, or whatever you're going to call them, delete, you know, whatever, restart, reset, whatever. Although tidy and clean are known safe words, so maybe just use those. But you don't have any targets. You don't really want to say, if this exists, then do this. You can just do that. Unless you do, in which case, go for it. But that's a makefile. That's all there is to it. Really, it's that simple. If you make a makefile like that, if you create a makefile like that, and you run make and then whatever command, whether it's HTML, PDF, clean, or tidy, then it will do all of its little automatic processing for you. And like I say, if you ever need to go back through and make some stupid change that would otherwise force you to regenerate all the HTML and all the FO and the PDF and, you know, do everything over again, you can really make this a lot simpler on yourself by simply making a make file that will do all that stuff for you. It's really, really nice. Give it a shot. It's a lot easier than you might think, and it is quite, quite convenient. Amazingly, I have one more tip, one more little hack that I do. And I know I'm supposed to be reviewing FreeBSD right now, and I haven't forgotten about that. I'm going to. But I did want to mention this other little hack that SoundChaser in IRC tipped me on about. And it's called PDFTK, is the main tool that it uses, although I also use ImageMagick along with it. But what this does is PDFTK is like a, I guess, toolkit probably for PDFs, and it can concatenate PDFs together. And that seems like kind of neat, right? But the really cool thing about this is that it maintains everything about that PDF, like all the hyperlinks, all the internal hyperlinks, everything that's going to open up a browser and make you go, and all the metadata, just all that stuff maintained pristinely. So if you grab PDFTK, again, it's going to be a lot of Java stuff included in there. Again, no GUI, but still Java. And it's a really, really great little tool. So check that one out, and I'll tell you how I use it right now. So DocBook, in terms of doing nice fancy covers, like something that you just went out in Inkscape or GIMP and created, and you want to stick it onto the front and the back of your book, it's not actually as easy as you'd think. I've tried a couple of different image-related tags in my DocBook sources, and I'm not getting it right. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Could be that it's, I mean, I'm doing it within the book tag. Maybe that's the wrong part. I don't know. So I'm doing something wrong. I'm sure that it exists in a way that, you know, that's easier than this. But this is the way that I've been doing it, and if it helps you, then great. And if not, then maybe you can tell me how DocBook is supposed to do it, and that would be cool too. But this is working for me right now. And that is that I'll go out to GIMP and Inkscape and make my little cover, and then I save it as either a PNG or a JPEG or a TIFF, just depending on the size concerns that I've got. And then I run a convert command on it. So convert frontcover.png space -page space, I think it's letter size. It's 219.4mm by 279.4mm, something like that. And I believe that's letter size paper. But anyway, for the convert command, you can do a -page and then define what size paper you want it to end up as. And that's kind of an important one. I mean, sometimes it auto-detects it quite well and you don't have to worry about it. I find that hard-coding it really helps. Space frontcover.pdf. So I've just taken the PNG, and I've run it through ImageMagick's convert function, hard-coded the page size into the document, and ended up with an exact duplicate of that graphic as a PDF. And I do the same thing with the back cover. So now I've got a front and a back cover in PDF form at the right size paper and ready to be appended and prepended to my docbook file. And the way to do that is you run PDFTK. So PDFTK space frontcover.pdf space mybook.pdf space backcover.pdf cat output mybook-covers.pdf. And sure enough, that will take all three PDF files and it will concatenate them together such that you've got a front and a back cover on your nice fancy PDF with all the hyperlinks maintained and everything. It's really, really cool. You should try this. Like I say, there might be a better way to do this in DocBook, or maybe not better, but alternate way. But for now, this is giving me the result that I really wanted, and so I'm happy. And now you know how to do it as well. So FreeBSD. FreeBSD 8.1 came out, and MonsterB was talking a little bit about it, and I decided finally that I should really give it a fair try. You might remember I think it was actually last season 4, I actually had PCBSD on my triple EPC, and I was running it for a little while, and I didn't love the way that it was reacting, and I kind of chalked that up to the triple EPC. There were weird little hangs and stuff like that that I really didn't like. But overall, I mean, it was a fairly positive experience, so I decided to give it a real go. And so I did have a spare laptop, a Celeron 900 x86-64 chip kind of deal, and so I downloaded FreeBSD 8.1 and installed it. Simple as that. And of course, FreeBSD boots to a text prompt, which frankly I liked, you know, because Flackware does the same thing, so I was fairly used to that. And so I started installing the packages that I figured I would want. So from ports, which turns out to be compiling from source code, I installed a couple of different things. Now, a lot of people talk about ports, and they kind of talk about it like you should know what it is. Well, as it turns out, ports is a thing that lives in /usr/ports, and you essentially pull the structure of ports down from a server somewhere. So you're just getting, like, the make files, essentially. Make files and little informational files and things like that, and the folder structure. So you're just getting, like, this weird skeleton of information about packages that exist out there. And you download that into /usr/ports. And then once it's all there, you can go into any of the directories that you want, like, let's just say textproc, and you can look around in there and see what kind of applications are there. And one of them might be, for instance, docbook-xml- or rather docbook-dtd-450, whatever. And so you could go into that directory, and if you do an ls, you would see something like a makefile, you'd see a package description or package info, something like that, and a couple of other files. But they're just small little files, and the way to install them would be that you say make install clean, and the makefile will then go out onto the internet and find the source code for the package that you're interested in. So in this case, it would be docbook. So it would go to docbook.org/xml/docbook-schema-4.5.zip, or whatever it would be, and it will download that into a folder called /usr/ports/distfiles. Downloads that source code in there, and then it processes the source code. It compiles it, and then, since you said install, so yeah, it installs it, and then it cleans up after itself and makes sure that all the spare little temporary files are gone and stuff like that. So this is a very cool method of doing things, obviously, right? I mean, this is compiling from source code to get your application installed. That, to me, is huge. It really is. And I don't mean that to be an elitist kind of like, oh, you must compile everything from source code. And I know that's not practical, and it's not correct, and all that other stuff. Except that it is, because people do it all the time. People using BSD do it. People using Slackware, you know, Slack builds specifically do it. So, I mean, it's, and people obviously using Gentoo if do that. So, I mean, it's something that people do. It's something that a lot of people really, really like. And I guess I must be one of those people, because whenever I get the chance to install something from source conveniently, I take it. And sometimes, frankly, not even that conveniently. But if a system kind of lets you do that, then I take it up on its offer. So I use ports a lot on this laptop that I have FreeBSD installed on, and I really, really like it. And no, it's not the fastest way to install software sometimes, because you do have to wait for it to compile. But you can tell yourself, you know for yourself exactly what version of software you've installed. You've known if there are any patches being applied. You know all that kind of information. And you know that if something is not working, then this is from, you know, you know how to trace it back in a way. And I like that. And you also know that you may have set flags for your processor and stuff like that. So, and you might have compiled certain options in, you know, certain codecs. For instance, if you're doing FFmpeg, which I'm always doing, or Audacity, certain options might be switched on or off. So compiling from source just seems like a more informed way of getting stuff onto your system to me, personally. So I like it. So USR/ports is really, really cool, and a big plus for BSD, I guess. And they're right. It is. It's a lot like Slack builds. It reminds me very much of Slack builds, and vice versa. So ports is really neat, and that's what it is. It's no mystery. I used to always wonder what people were talking about when they would say, oh, well, BSD uses a port system. It's really great. It's far superior to everything else out there. Well, what are you talking about? Well, that's what they're talking about. You go in there, you look around at these little skeleton files, and then you tell it to make and install and clean. And because we just learned about make files in this very episode, you now know kind of like how all that happens. You say make, install, clean. Well, what you're saying is do whatever is listed under the install section, and then do whatever is listed under the clean section. And that's what it does. So it goes out and it downloads the source code into a specific folder, it compiles it, it installs it onto your system, and then it cleans up. Simple as that. And you do that for each different port that you want to install. And like I say, sometimes it does take a while because it is compiling from source. And on a Celeron 900, it's not really that fast. But, you know, if you do it while you're at work or something or overnight, then you're good to go pretty much. One thing I don't seem to like about ports very much, and I don't know exactly if there's a way around this. I imagine there is. But the configuration options seem to not really it's not complete, so I've issued a port install of something, or a make install clean, and it'll start compiling, and then it will hit a dependency that it's installing, and it finds that you need to configure that dependency. Maybe there's an option in the configuration options to turn on debugging, or to turn on language support, or to turn on some kind of codec or not. And so it stops, and it takes you to this incursus configuration screen, and it asks you to select what options you do want on, and then you're supposed to hit return. And that's fine for, like, you know, the little text editor that you're installing, and it has a couple of different options, and you say, you know, you define which ones you want, then you hit return, and it continues, and it goes along and completes the task. But now imagine installing KDE from source. All right, maybe your text editor was Kwrite. So now you have to pull in all these KDE packages, and for each of these different packages, the configuration options are different, and then they hit dependencies that have yet more configuration options, and so on. So it felt like me, I mean, for me, when I did start compiling KDE from source, I mean, I left, you know, overnight thinking it was just going to keep going. And I'd even set some kind of option, I think it was like a configure in advance kind of option. And it let me configure, I guess, some of them in advance, but I guess it didn't know about certain other ones. And so I guess maybe the workaround would be to go install the dependencies first, which would ostensibly be smaller and faster to install, faster to compile, get that configuration and installation out of the way, and then install KDE at large. But it would be nice if there was, like, some way to automatically set all the configuration. And again, there probably is, and I just don't know it, so I'm not going to say that's a shortage of the ports system. I'm not quite that presumptuous. And then the other issue, I guess, with the ports system is that it does resolve dependencies. call me crazy, but I don't love that. I don't hate it by any means, because granted, it makes life really easy sometimes. But at the same time, I just feel like I feel so uninformed when I'm doing, you know, a port install, and I look over and I see that it's pulling in, you know, a gigabyte of Java packages, and I had no idea what I was in for. Part of that is because I didn't read, you know, I didn't do a make port list or make port info or whatever it is, where I think you actually do, you do a make search, name equals, quote, foo, end quote, and then it finds the package with the name foo, and it tells you exactly where it's located in the port directory, and I think it tells you what it depends on and stuff like that. So either way, you could figure all that stuff out. You could look at what the dependencies are. I'm sure there's an option to say don't handle dependencies or something like that. I don't know it yet, and it kind of surprised me when I saw that it actually was pulling in things that I didn't really anticipate. It's not quite like SBOPKG so far that you can open up a README file and you kind of have to open up a README file and see what it depends on and then go install all the dependencies on your own, which I actually prefer. Other people would disagree, I'm sure, and I'm sure, like I say, there's a way to change all of that stuff because, hey, it's Unix. Okay, so there you go. That's the port system. So when you install FreeBSD, I mean, there are little things that you can do. I mean, there's a lot of... It's just like installing Debian or Slackware. I mean, it's the same kind of deal. It's that incursus interface. You can partition your disk, define how you want your file system structured, on which partitions and stuff like that, and then you tell it to install everything. Now, one of the options will be to install ports, to go ahead and pull ports down for you. Another option will be to set your root password, obviously, and I think you can create your users and set up your network and things like that. But once you reboot and you're actually on FreeBSD, you sign in as the user and you have to install a lot of stuff, like from ports. You know, you have to install X, you have to install a window manager and a desktop environment and whatever else you want. Now, I installed X from ports, so that was compiled, and then I tried KDE, but like I say, I was having configuration issues where I wanted to walk away and let it compile for the next 24 hours, and it just kept asking me for configuration options. So I went ahead and did what's called a package install, apparently, of KDE. And that is a very simple command. It's called /add --r whatever the name of the package for KDE4 was. I think it was KDE4. And that the -r thing, I forget what that stands for, but it means to look out onto the internet and grab the actual package from the internet because you have not downloaded the package itself yet. And I hadn't. So if you do that, it will find on FreeBSD FTP server somewhere the package called, let's just say, KDE4, and then it will install that binary package onto your system. So that's akin to, for instance, a Slack package, where you've got the package, it's compiled, it's pre-compiled, all you have to do is issue like an install PKG command, and it installs, it just explodes the package and puts it where it's supposed to be on your on the file system. So that's really easy and really fast, and that's a nice option to have, because sometimes, yeah, you don't want to have to do the whole thing from source. So I installed KDE from a package, and I launched KDE, and I have to say that it wasn't really working all that well. It seemed to have a lot of trouble launching applications. There's some issue, and again, it's probably something that I'm not setting, but there's some issue with KDE init 4. And KDE init 4 is actually the process that launches every KDE process. So for KDE init 4 not to be working, I'm not really sure exactly, or not working reliably, I'm not really sure what the problem is, but it was a problem. And this is the only problem I've had, this is the only place I've had it on. I mean, I've used KDE on Fedora and Slackware, but I guess both of those must do something to get KDE working on that system, and maybe this is just something that I don't know about that I need to set for FreeBSD. But I was having real issues with that. I mean, I would try to start an application, and it would simply say, I can't start that application because KLauncher isn't running, or because I can't find application name .desktop. Just random things like that, and I really can't explain it, but neither have I really looked into it. But just know that if you're going to try FreeBSD, I think that there might be quite a bit of configuration work that you're going to have to do. That's the negative spin on it, right? The positive way of looking at that, and this is not just a spin, this is actually what I think. You're learning Unix again, you know? I mean, if you're like me, you've gotten to a certain point with Linux where you're pretty darn good at it. Maybe you can kind of hold your own at a lug meeting. Someone asks you a question, and at first you freak out because you're like, no, I'm not a Linux guru. And then suddenly you hear yourself giving the answer, and you have no idea where this is coming from, but there you go. You know this stuff now. That's a really cool place to be, and it's really kind of exciting, you know, when someone actually asks a question, and you can actually get your way through an answer. Maybe not super gracefully, not like, you know, a pro like Jay Lindsay, but, I mean, you can do it. You can tell them, okay, here's what you need to do, let's work our way through it. Or maybe sometimes you do, you just whip out the answer, and it's just that easy. So, I mean, that's a great place to be. It's really exciting for yourself, and probably for some other people, when you reach that point. But you have to also kind of imagine that maybe you are, maybe you're like king of this side of the mountain, and you don't realize that right on the other side there's like this whole other kingdom that you could go over and conquer and kill all their peasants and stuff. Taking that analogy probably a little bit too far there, but you know, you've got your little niche and you could probably expand a bit. So going over to BSD or even OpenSolaris if you want, if that still exists. I think it doesn't, but there's a community version of it and so on and so forth. But going over to BSD, which, by the way, is a free license, whereas Solaris, you know, is like, what, CDDL at best? So going over to BSD, you're kind of delving into this new world, and I didn't know that at the time. I thought I was just going to be delving into a different world. Like, instead of using ModProbe, I'm going to be using KLD Loader instead. Little things like that. Not that big of a deal. It's just kind of like, do I really want to learn a new command for doing the same thing? But it goes beyond that, because there's a lot of stuff in FreeBSD that's just not done for you yet. And I say yet, because, like, on PC BSD, I presume, and Ghost BSD, and projects like this that are geared toward getting that BSD desktop to where it kind of needs to be for the lighter weight Unix users who aren't quite ready to get in and configure everything themselves, which is not a bad thing, you know. Or maybe you just want a quick fix and you just want the desktop and you don't really care about the configuration options as long as it generally works. Those are great for that, and that is just a matter of learning different commands maybe. But for something like FreeBSD, where you need to configure everything and stuff like that, this could be very good, because there are realms of Unix that maybe you've forgotten, you know, like hand configuring zorg.conf. Who does that anymore? Well, you just might on FreeBSD, and random things like that. So you learn interesting little things that you maybe wouldn't really think about nowadays on a modern Linux system, because on BSD it's not at the same place. Now, happily, one of my first tasks on Slackware, my first real distribution that I was running on a daily basis, was installing Intel wireless drivers, which, strangely, well, it had the open source drivers out there, but it wasn't included in that version of Slackware yet. And so I had to find that, and this was my first, you know, I've never dealt with drivers before, and I'd never dealt with Linux before, so that was kind of my first big task. So that kind of thing is kind of old to me now, so when I went over to FreeBSD and found out that the Realtek Wi-Fi card did not have a driver included in the BSD kernel or the BSD packaging and stuff, I got to learn how to install drivers on a Unix box again. And it had been a little while. I mean, not that long, because, I mean, Broadcom continues to haunt me to this day. But, you know, you get to do little things like that you kind of have forgotten about. And then still other things you might just not even think about at all. Just some of the configuration that you might have to go do for, you know, some random package. You have to go in there and edit that text conf file again. And it's really actually quite refreshing in a sense. It's kind of cool to be thinking, wow, Linux has come so far that we just don't have to worry about that anymore or this anymore. So it's really kind of an interesting comparison. So I guess I would be remiss if I didn't talk about multimedia. I guess I probably should have warned you that we're going to do a little bit of an extra long episode this time. I decided not to worry about the clock since this is the last episode of the season. So if you want to go get another coffee break, you can go do that.
You like coffee? I do. You should drink it. I do.
So, multimedia on BSD. Well, yes. Maybe I'm not going to be doing a BSDmedia.info anytime soon. Now, a certain number of things I can chalk up to me not really knowing a whole lot about BSD. I would like to know somehow, and I don't expect you to be able to tell me this, dear listener, but I mean, I would love to kind of somehow find out how many people are using free BSD for serious multimedia content creation. And if I had to hazard a guess, I would say it's not that many people. And I don't mean any of this in a negative light at all, but I do a lot of multimedia stuff, and I do really all of my multimedia stuff on Slackware. Slackware 13.1, Lenovo laptop right now, with an Intel Mobile 4 card, and I think it's a Pentium 4 processor with 2 gigs of RAM. I mean, it's not like the fanciest setup ever. So I took a computer with fairly similar specs, really. I mean, it's a Toshiba, not quite as nice as the Lenovo. It's got a Intel Mobile chip 4, and it's got a Celeron chip, not a Pentium 4. I think it might be, they're both 64-bit, and, well, one's a Realtek card, one's a Broadcom card or something like that. Yeah, I mean, little differences here and there, obviously, but in terms of power and capability and stuff, they're pretty much on par. So trying to work in various multimedia applications on BSD. Audacity, I installed via ports, so it was a custom compile. I didn't really do anything fancy in terms of configuration. It was the same standard configuration that I use for Slackware. It's the same version as what I'm using on Slackware. And wouldn't you know, I'm getting all kinds of weird errors, like really, really weird problems within Audacity that appear after really, really heavy use. Okay, so if I open it up and I do lightweight audio editing in it, it's not a problem. I've edited about 8 or 10 Ohio Linux Fest audio promos on the FreeBSD laptop in Audacity. It's worked fine. It's been great. From that experience, I would have said it was perfect. It was just what you needed for multimedia. That, of course, would be a generalization without any kind of qualification, which is a bad thing. So I then decided to continue down that path of audio editing on FreeBSD and tried a couple of different projects. One project had sound sources from about 3 different people using 3 different pieces of equipment at 3 different sample rates. And at that point, Audacity just started giving me all kinds of weird errors. Like, I mean, literally, almost inexplicable errors to me, and that's what makes me think that I'm probably just missing something, or I need to recompile a kernel or something. But, I mean, there were, like, literally audio processing strangeness, which I can't say maybe, because I took it over to Slackware and it's working. So, you know, it's weird things that I've never really seen Audacity do, like not being able to find the baseline for what is considered 0 decibels, literally offsetting the audio at places that are non-zero, and you have to kind of normalize to bring it back down. I mean, I've seen that happen on certain recordings, but it's not happening on my Slackware Audacity install, so it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense that it would be happening on the FreeBSD box. And then a lot of little graphic quirks and things like that. This was without any kind of 3D acceleration turned on, no fancy effects, it's just a straight up normal Zorg graphic driver for the Intel Mobile 4 chip. Again, the same one that I'm using on Slackware, and the same version of Audacity, and all these other things, and they're both compiled from source code. So, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to me. I'm not clear on what the variable is, aside from the fact that they are different computers with a different processor, and one mustn't underestimate that. I mean, I realize that they're both 64 chip, but I imagine they've got to be different in some way. So, whatever the issue, Audacity works for normal use, and not so much for normal use, where the second normal equals power users. So the graphic side of things actually isn't much better. Inkscape keeps crashing on me. If I'm in Inkscape really for very long at all, it inevitably crashes. Sometimes if I just try to launch it at all, it'll be there, and then I'll open a document and it crashes. Little things like that. So that's probably a library somewhere, I imagine. Because I remember when Inkscape came out, I think it was actually 0.47, I think it was a beta release of that, and I was having a weird library issue on Slackware as well. So, and now I don't have that on Slackware, but that this is the proper release. Maybe the BSDs, I'd have to check the version and stuff. Maybe they're using the beta, maybe they're using the stable, but a library somewhere conflicts. I don't really know. Point is, Inkscape's not giving me a whole lot of success on FreeBSD, to the point that I open it up if I know that I have an SVG that I need to export as a bitmap for use in GIMP. And that's about all I can squeeze out of Inkscape, because anything beyond that, it will crash. So Inkscape is basically not working for me on FreeBSD from the port install, on my install of FreeBSD. I'm not saying it won't work for you, I'm simply saying it's not working for me. And again, KDE is just not really working for me. I can use Dolphin, I can use Conqueror, I can use Kwrite or Qt, and Console. And that's about it. If I try to launch, you know, KOffice or something, it's not going to happen, or it's going to happen and it's going to be ridiculously slow. So basically both of my experiences on PCBSD and FreeBSD so far have not been great with KDE. I don't know why that is. I don't know what the problem in terms of, you know, these weird pauses are happening. That's the best way I can describe it, not being, a guru and everything. So I'll be working and then the computer doesn't freeze, you know, but you can tell that the processor is working on something. And you can move your mouse maybe, or you can do some other stuff, but something is kind of in a delay. And then it continues. And you think, it was probably just a random occurrence. And then you keep going and it happens again. And you think, it's just random. It's not going to happen again. It's not going to happen all the time. And then it happens all the time periodically, you know, just kind of steadily. And so I really can't use KDE for that reason on the BSDs. And I'm not sure why, and it concerns me, because I know that BSD is really cool, and I know that KDE is really cool, so they should be really cool together. But something that I'm not configuring properly, I'll bet, is not having them be cool together. But that's okay, because I'm sure it's something that can be remedied. The really big deal here is that BSD is the other big free Unix out there. In fact, it is the free Unix out there, because as we all know, GNU's not Unix, and neither is Linux. So you got these Unix-like systems that we know and love, and they have the GPL to back them up. And I think that the GPL is of the utmost importance. I really, really do. I think that it's a very progressive license. The FreeBSD license is very conservative. It's conservative in an unusual way. It's very conservatively free. That is to say that, as we all know, you know, it says, hey, here's the code, do whatever you want to with it as long as you don't change the name of the author. And that's their only requirement, as far as I know. That is a very free license. It's freer than free. It's completely free. I wouldn't call that at all progressive, however. You know, I mean, that doesn't promote more freedom to spring up. It simply says this is free. So you can have your little philosophical debate over which is better and which is more free and less free and all this other stuff. But the cool thing is that they're both free, and they are both very, obviously, very Unix-y. And BSD seems to pride itself on doing things completely in the Unix. You know, I mean, they're kind of like the torchbearer of Unix, of true Unix, because they are true Unix. Now, Slackware, of course, is very into being the most Unix-like Linux distribution, and I admire it very much for that, and it's probably one of the big reasons that I use it at all, because it is very Unix-y. You can always expect things to work a certain way in Slackware, and it all kind of follows that Unix philosophy that I'm so interested and fascinated and in love with. Well, same goes for BSD. There's a lot of stuff in BSD that you can just tell is very, very Unix-y. It's got all the files where you'd expect them to be. There's a /usr/local/share, and it uses it. It uses it properly. It uses it the same way every time. There are conf files in places, and they are used, and you actually edit them. You know, things like that. I mean, these aren't big deals, but they kind of are, in the sense that everyone's trying to almost get away from that right now. So BST is a very important project, obviously. I mean, you don't need me to tell you that. I realize that. But I'm acknowledging it, I guess. It's a very cool little project, big project. And it's something that I think you could do worse than install FreeBSD. I think it would be an interesting experience. I wouldn't say to take your main workstation and put FreeBSD on it. You know, I mean, it's not just another Linux distribution. It is Unix, and it is going to be very, very familiar to you, frightfully familiar to you in some cases. And then in other cases, there might just be a lot of configuration things that you're going to need to do that maybe you haven't ever done before, or maybe that it's even to the point I'm suspecting maybe some things actually need to be ported over to BSD in order to work properly. And I'm wondering if that's not the problem with maybe either Inkscape or Audacity or something. And there are patches in a lot of the ports that actually, I guess, account for that sort of thing. And that actually segues perfectly into my other point, my big, I guess, final point about BSD and why it's important. BSD is the little guy right now in terms of fame and fortune. You know, it's very, very popular. It's almost ubiquitous. So they don't have the mind share of a lot of the Linux developers or the application for Linux developers. And this is something that I was talking to the maintainer of OpenCSW with the Solaris project about, and that is the importance of portable code. Now, it's kind of really bad for me to be talking about portable code because I'm not a programmer, and I realize that. So I have no idea what I'm talking about. I have no idea the complexity of what I'm talking about. But speaking to people who are programmers, and kind of investigating as much as I can within, you know, a couple of afternoons of reading and stuff like that, it just strikes me that portable code is a really good idea. And portable code was and is one of the primary Unix beliefs, you know, that your code should go from one computer, take the source and go to another computer, compile it, and it will work. And that is portable code. And so someone should be able to write their source code according to this big Unix spec, which I guess is POSIX, but I'm not really 100% sure about that. But, you know, they write their code for Unix, and you could take it to Linux, and you could take it to BSD, and you could take it to Solaris, and yes, you could take it to Mac OS X, and you can compile it, and it will work. And that is portability. And the reason I care about that are, I guess, twofold. One is because when I was first getting into Unix, it was on Mac OS X. I was doing weird things like trying to get GNU Step to work on OS X. You know, I was compiling stuff from code and finding that I couldn't just download something from SourceForge and do exactly what it tells me to do and have it work on OS X. And sometimes that completely stopped me from having something that I wanted on OS X, you know, in the X environment. So, I mean, at that point, of course, I was just literally all I was using in OS X was the Darwin kernel. Well, I mean, I had the Darwin kernel and then Cocoa and then the Cocoa emulation of implementation of Zorg. So basically Zorg in a Cocoa little shell, except that full screen, so you couldn't tell that the Cocoa was running behind it. It was very, very inefficient, and that is, of course, why I switched to Linux. Wow, see how this last episode of The Bad Apples is kind of becoming like this retrospective of The Bad Apples? It's kind of becoming like this. I know there's got to be some emotional music for this. Hold on. You know, back when I was using OS X, and it was very inefficient, and that's probably why I switched to Linux in the end anyway, or one of the many reasons why I did. So, I mean, in that sense, I guess it was good. But that's still not a good argument for non-portable code. Portable code is still the ideal, and that is the second reason that I like it, because that's probably enough of that music. And that's the second reason I like it, because I think that multi-platformedness is a really important cause. You know, I think that if we want free software, and I'm talking now GPL brand, viral, militant, hardcore free software to spread, we need to consider that it needs to be multi-platform. The way to include everyone is not to exclude those who don't come to be with us. You know, it's to include everyone. It really is. So, I mean, think about it. That's how Firefox has become really the browser, right? I mean, because they have it for Windows, they have it for Mac, they have it for Linux. That's how OpenOffice is doing so well. They've got it for every platform. It's really easy to install now. It's what KDE is working on, you know. And think about it. I mean, you might think, oh, we don't want Windows users to be able to use our software anyway. Why would we want to write it such that it was multi-platform? Well, actually, you do want people to use it, and maybe you yourself wants to use it, because if you're ever assigned to do any task on a Windows box, wouldn't it be nice to be able to go to KDE.org and just download a binary or something, and bang, you've got Dolphin and Conqueror and K-Write and Kate and Gwynview and Copete and all these other great KDE applications, so you don't have to use any of the Windows stuff. I mean, that would be pretty nice, actually. So when I say portable, I mean portable with a capital P. I mean compile it on any Unix box you walk up to and go beyond that and make it multi-platform. Again, I have no idea what's involved with that. You know, I mean, that could be a monumental task. But I still have a sense that truly portable Unix code probably isn't monumentally hard, because it does exist. You know, you'll find those little applications out there that you just grab, and I don't care if you're on Linux, on BSD, on OpenSolaris, or on Mac OS X, it just compiles. And it's such a nice feeling, it really is, when you do that .configure, it detects everything that it is looking for, and then you do the make, and it, again, detects everything that it's looking for, and it doesn't need you to change any environment variable or any, you know, you don't have to go into the header files and include something else. It just works. And that's really, really cool. Now, the neat thing about BSD, of course, is that they've implemented a Linux emulation layer or something like that. And that will actually enable things that I guess are written very specifically for Linux, which, again, I think is really, really, that's kind of, in a way, that's a pity, you know, that things would be that specific to Linux and not universal enough to run on another, you know, Unix system, even though Linux isn't Unix. But they do have that going for them, and so I guess that's supposed to help a lot. And again, I'm just, in the back of my mind, I keep thinking, well, gee, I wonder how much of what I'm running is on that little emulation layer, and I wonder how much of these little errors that I'm seeing, especially in my multimedia stuff, is due to that. So who knows, you know, and that's, again, why portable code would really, really rock. So BSD, I guess one of the other tenets of what they do, one of their beliefs is not to rush things, is not to try to race to the finish. This, I am of two minds about, I guess. I mean, in one way, that's obviously very, very admirable, because now you've got, like, this system that just makes sure that it's doing everything in the most right Unix-y way that it possibly can. And who can't admire that kind of, you know, that kind of staunch, I guess, again, conservatism. I like that. I really do. I can admire that all day. And again, that's why I like Slackware, for that same kind of, that kind of trait. On the other hand, as someone who uses a computer and uses it every day and uses it for stuff that other OSs are doing, and I mean, sometimes I feel like Linux isn't progressing fast enough, you know, much less trying to go over to BSD for a little while. And I've been using, I should have probably said at the very beginning, I've been using FreeBSD for about a month straight now. So that's not forever, but it's like literally, I've been using it like day in and day out for about a month. So I gather that's by choice, because they're not rushing for quick hacks. They're trying to get it right. And that's an important precedence, and that's an important, someone's got to do that, right? So the fact that they're doing it is nice. It's really, really nice. So they're highly recommended, and yet, you know, not recommended for maybe everything that you possibly would do. At this, you know, I mean, as a DocBook box, that laptop is great. Except that it doesn't really have a very long battery life. That's got nothing to do with BSD, though. It's never had a very long battery life, so. But, you know, for certain things, I mean, if your workflow involves certain things, then you're going to be fine, and you'd really enjoy it, I think, and you'll learn a lot. For other certain things, you might not be able to enjoy it quite as much. Another positive side, there's no flash on BSD, I think. That's kind of cool. It's really cool. Unless you could do it through the Linux emulator. That would be a pity. But anyway, yeah, that's my experience so far with FreeBSD. If it tells you anything, it's still on my Toshiba. So I'm, you know, enjoying it enough to use it as much as I kind of possibly can. Obviously, I avoid it for some of the heavier weight multimedia activity that I'm doing. Although, to be fair, I've done a lot of multimedia stuff on it. I've gone ahead and struggled through certain things. So yeah, I mean, overall, I'm really, really enjoying it. I really am. It's really cool. The lack of GPL notwithstanding, it's a really neat system, and you should definitely check it out. And, you know, just one more thing, since I'm throwing time here to the wind. you know, it's always, there's, and I know that you probably agree with me, dear listener, so I'm going to go ahead and mention it, but there's this, I know that there's a healthy paranoia among Linux geeks. I know this. So I don't feel like I'm sounding too crazy when I say that don't you have that, like, in the back of your mind, that little fear that someone's going to come along and Linux is going to disappear? You know, whatever might cause it, somehow Linux is going to go away. It could be a legal action. It could be all the developers, all the main developers get jobs at Microsoft or something, and they quit developing the Linux kernel. You know, who knows? You have to admit to yourself that as a paranoid, a vaguely paranoid Linux geek, these things cross your mind. And so to kind of ease that nagging fear in the back of your brain, getting to know a little bit more about BSD and stuff really does help. It helps buffer that, because now you feel secure, like you have a fallback plan. You know, hey, if Linux ever dies, it's okay, we'll always have BSD. I mean, look at Solaris. Case in point, am I right? So, check it out. It's really interesting and cool and educational. It's fun. I do have a better 2D implementation of its little demon head, little 3D head that FreeBSD uses, which, by the way, is far superior to that demon with the little sneakers on. So that little demon head, they got like this glassy sort of 3D-looking demon head. I did a 2D implementation of that. I think that's located on openclipart.org. Okay, again, because I'm just absolutely not respecting time on this final episode of The Bad Apples, and the final season episode. So, for that reason, I'm going to go ahead and mention one more thing, and that is openclipart.org. And I've actually, I think, mentioned this before, and other podcasts have, but I need to revisit it because it has come a long way. They consider themselves still in beta, but from the time that I originally visited them, which, I mean, was well over a year ago, they were almost unusable. And I say well over a year, so I could be like a year behind right now, but it was a long time ago, and it was nearly unusable. They didn't have anything on the site, and search results frequently returned nothing, even though there were clearly some things on their page. You know, it was really, really, well, I mean, it was bad is how it came across. I mean, it's got to be hard to set up such a thing. So I'm not saying that they weren't doing a good job. I'm just saying that to a dumb user like me going to the site in a browser, wanting to see if I could find some kind of free clip art, it was really, really bad. But now, like 2 nights ago, I went there, and wouldn't you know, it's a beautiful, incredible, helpful, plentiful site. It's got open. It's got clip art all over the place. And the great thing about this is that it's all public domain. And I know you're thinking, but public domain is supposed to be so horrible. It's supposed to be, you know, anyone can use it, and there's all these, it's like the worst kind of license ever. But think about it. Clip art is clip art, right? Clip art is needed by everyone for all kinds of different things. And the minute you have to start thinking about, well, can I use this image? Nope, that one doesn't have the right license. Well, let me go find another second, almost as good, but not quite as good, other one that has a license that agrees with the rest of my stuff. The minute you start having to think about that kind of thing, well, it's almost easier to just commission an artist to draw the stupid thing for you, or to learn how to draw and do it yourself. Like, literally, I mean, when you're looking for clip art, that's how much patience you have. I know that's how much patience I have. But open clip art makes it just really, really kind of a no-brainer, and it's public domain. Meaning, I guess, that it doesn't really have a license, sort of, or something. I mean, like, no rights are reserved, basically. So, I mean, that's a big deal, and it's really nice. I've contributed like 5 little random SVGs that I happened to have, and they are all SVGs, so they're all scalable. They're completely resolution independent. They're license independent. You can use them for anything. It's really, really great, and there are some really quality things. And if it clues you in on just how quality it is, I mean, Niku and Moren from Fedora Project Art Team contribute to it quite regularly. And frankly, just browsing through it, I was really, really amazed. And the cool thing, too, is that it's not geek art. You know, it's not just a whole bunch of SVGs of computers and mice. You know, it's got a lot, it's got a great range. It's got people and school supplies and geek art, and more people and more school supplies. I don't really know. Planes, road signs, just whatever you need. Just go there and type it in, and you'll be amazed at their offering. So really, really neat progress happening over at openclipart.org. Check that place out, and if you're someone who does little drawings and stuff, you know, consider uploading. It's actually quite easy to upload. So you know, you register. It's like a they've got three fields for different text, and then you're in, and then you can upload. It's really simple. And they only accept SVGs, so that makes it really nice and small and easy. And, yeah, it's really great. And you can obviously download it and modify it for yourself, too. So if there's something that's almost exactly what you want but not quite, download it. It's SVG. Open it in Inkscape and edit it. You're good. Go for it. OpenClipArt.org. And now I do believe, at long last, that's the end of this episode. And the end of the series. Who knew? Who knew I was going to call it quits so soon in the series' life? But again, I'm not really calling it quits. It's just going to become the GNU World Order, right? Yeah, the GNU World Order. And it'll be exactly the same. It'll be exactly the same, except with a new name that I can actually talk to people about and not feel really self-conscious about. So enjoy the GNU World Order when it happens next semester, next season, whatever it's called. And as for hiatus, I usually don't take very long hiatus between seasons, so don't like take me out of your feed or anything. And again, the feeds are all going to stay the same, so don't worry about that. So don't remove me. Just you know, forget about me for like 2 weeks, maybe three. Okay, so I don't know, go get another cup of coffee or something. That's probably what I'm going to do. So thanks for listening to the show, of course, and I'll talk to you next season.
The GNU World Order.